desperate and killed those possessed of the devil, or carried out the devil's work. Toby is asking these kinds of questions.
Do you know what you say?
Are you? And you speak ill of the devil, how he takes it at heart? Pray God he be not bewitched.
Carry his water to the wise woman.
Take his urine to the wise woman, and she can tell if he is possessed.
Marry, and it shall be done tomorrow morning, if I live. My lady would not lose him for more than I'll say.
How now, mistress?
Oh, Lord!
Prithee, hold thy peace. This is not the way. Do you not see you move him? Let me alone with him.
No way but gentleness. Gently, gently. The fiend is rough, and will not be roughly used.
He is possessed of a demon, so you must be gentle. These three are just loving this joke at Malvolio's expense.
Why, how now, my bawcock? How dost thou, Chuck?
He is flattering him, saying bawcock, or fine chap, and Chuck is a term of endearment, like Chig.
Sir?
Aye, Biddy, come with me. What, man? "'Tis not for gravity to play at cherry-pit with Satan. Hang him, foul collier!'
Toby accuses him of playing cherry-pit, a type of billiards, with the devil or Satan. And for that he will be hanged in hell by a demonic collier or miner.
"'Get him to say his prayers, good Sir Toby. Get him to pray!'
"'My prayers, minx!'
"'No, I warrant you he will not hear of godliness!'
"'Go hang yourselves all!'
Of course, an inability to pray is a definite sign of evil. Shakespeare uses this in Macbeth, when, after the murder of Duncan, Macbeth cannot say Amen. So, without realizing it, Malvolio gives them further evidence that he is possessed.
You are idle, shallow things. I am not of your element. You shall know more hereafter.
Malvolio really believes that he's above them, and leaves, possibly to find Olivia.
Is possible? If this were played upon a stage now, I could condemn it as an improbable fiction.
If he saw this on stage, he wouldn't believe it. This kind of self-referential joke seems incredibly modern, but is, of course, 400 years old.
His very genius hath taken the infection of the device, man.
Nay, pursue him now, lest the device take air and taint.
We must carry on with it. Don't let the joke die. It's too funny to lose.
Why, we shall make him mad indeed.
The house will be the quieter.
Come, we'll have him in a dark room and bound. My niece is already in the belief that he's mad. We may carry it thus, for our pleasure and his penance, till our very pastime, tired out of breath, prompt us to have mercy on him, at which time we will bring the device to the bar and crown thee for a finder of madmen.
What started out as fun suddenly turns very black. They plan to shut him in a dark cell, tied up, until he's insane, which shouldn't be too difficult, as Olivia thinks he's mad already.
But see,
more matter for a May morning.
Sir Andrew enters, waving the challenge he's written to Cesario.
Here's the challenge. Read it. I warrant there's vinegar and pepper in't.
Is't so saucy?
Aye, is't. I warrant him. Do but read.
Give me. Youth, whatsoever thou art but a scurvy fellow.
Good. And valiant.
Wonder not, nor admire not in thy mind, why I do call thee so, for I will show thee no reason for it.
A good note. That keeps you from the blow of the law.
Meaning, he can't sue you for libel.
Thou comest to the Lady Olivia, and in my sight she uses thee kindly. But thou liest in thy throat. That is not the matter I challenge thee for.
Very brief, and to exceeding good sense, less.
Another use of language that seems very modern, like the comic aside. I think you're beautiful. Not.
I will waylay thee going home, where, if it be thy chance to kill me...
Good.
..thou killst me like a rogue and a villain.
Still you keep on the windy side of the law. Good.
Again, he can't be sued because he doesn't actually call Cesario a villain, but compares him to one.
Fare thee well, and God have mercy upon one of our souls. He may have mercy upon mine, but my hope is better, and so look to thyself. Thy friend, as thou usest him, and thy sworn enemy, Andrew Legajig. Oh, if this letter move him not, his legs cannot, I'll give it him.
Sir Toby offers to issue the challenge for his friend.
You may have very fit occasion for it. He is now in some commerce with my lady and will by and by depart.
Go, Sir Andrew. Scout me for him at the corner of the orchard like a bum bailey.
He's hanging around the garden somewhere like a bum bailey, a debt collector, who waits around a debtor's house for the opportunity to confront them.
So soon as ever thou seest him, draw. And as thou drawest, swear horrible. For it comes to pass oft that a terrible oath, with a swaggering accent sharply twanged off, gives manhood more approbation than ever proof itself would have earned him. Away!
He's just a kid. You can frighten him with terrible swearing and curses.
Nay, let me alone for swearing.
No need to tell me about swearing, says Sir Andrew as he exits. I'm the best. Sir Toby and Fabian are now alone.
Now, will not I deliver his letter? For the behaviour of the young gentleman gives him out to be of good capacity and breeding. His employment between his lord and my niece confirms no less. Therefore, this letter, being so excellently ignorant, will breed no terror in the youth. He will find it comes from a clodpole. But, sir, I will deliver his challenge by word of mouth. Set upon Ague Cheek a notable report of valour, and drive the gentleman, as I know his youth will aptly receive it, into a most hideous opinion of his rage, skill, fury, and impetuosity. This will so fright them both that they will kill one another by the look like cockatrices.
The letter is so badly written that if Cesario were to read it, he'd know Sir Andrew is an idiot who poses no threat. But if Sir Toby delivers the challenge by word of mouth, he can put the frighteners on Cesario, and then tell Sir Andrew how angrily Cesario received the challenge and what a great fighter he is. Sir Toby plans to play them off against each other and create such fear that they will be afraid even to look at each other. The cockatrice is a mythical creature, a bit like a dragon crossed with a rooster. Legend has it that its look could turn a man to stone and its toxic breath could kill.
Here he comes with your niece. Give them way till he take leave, and presently after him.
I will meditate the while upon some horrid message for a challenge.
So Fabian and Toby leave. Toby is to decide on what gruesome challenge he'll deliver to poor Cesario. As they leave the stage, enter Olivia and Cesario, Viola in disguise, talking as they walk.
Oh, I have said too much, unto a heart of stone, and laid mine honour too uncherry on't.
Her words make no impact upon his hard heart. She tries to show him that she loves him and trusts him with her honour, but to no avail.
There's something in me that reproves my fault, but such a headstrong, potent fault it is that it but mocks reproof.
With the same behaviour that your passion bears goes on my master's griefs. Here, wear this jewel for me, 'tis my picture. Refuse it not. It hath no tongue to vex you. And, I beseech you, come again tomorrow. What shall you ask of me that I'll deny, that honour saved may upon asking give?
Nothing but this, your true love for my master.
Oh, how with mine honour may I give him that which I have given to you?
Olivia won't give up. She wants him to wear a locket containing her picture and to keep coming to visit her. But Viola sticks to her task. Will Olivia love Orsino?
I will acquit you.
Well, come again tomorrow. Fare thee well. A fiend like thee might bear my soul to hell.
And Olivia exits, wondering if this pain she's in is caused by a demon who has taken the shape of Cesario in order to damn her. This leaves Viola alone, and in comes Sir Toby and Fabian.
Gentlemen, God save thee.
And you, sir.
That defence thou hast, betake thee to it. Of what nature the wrongs are thou hast done him, I know not. But thy interceptor, full of despite, bloody as the hunter, attends thee at the orchard end. Dismount thy tuck. Be yar in thy preparation, for thy assailant is quick, skilful, and deadly.
There's a man at the end of the orchard who wants your blood. Take your sword out and fight. A tuck is a thin Spanish duelling sword with a point and no cutting edge.
You mistake, sir. I am sure no man hath any quarrel to me.
My remembrance is very free and clear from any image of offence done to any man.
You'll find it otherwise, I assure you. Therefore, if you hold your life at any price, betake you to your guard. For your opposite hath in him what youth, strength, skill, and wrath can furnish man withal.
I pray you, sir, what is he?
He is knight, dubbed with unhatched rapier and on carpet consideration, but he is a devil in private brawl.
That carpet reference, by the way, means he received his knighthood kneeling on a carpet, not in battle. Toby got his fighting in Holland, and there's a difference between a fighting knight and one who just gets dubbed by a grateful monarch. So Toby is saying, even though he's a carpet knight, he's a devil.
Souls and bodies hath he divorced three. And his incensement at this moment is so implacable that satisfaction can be none but by pangs of death and sepulchre.
He's already killed three people in quarrels and talks about nothing but death, and he wants you.
Hobnob is his word. Give it or take it.
Hobnob was in those days a duelling term, meaning have at you.
I will but turn again into the house and desire some conduct of the lady. I am no fighter. I have heard of some kind of men that put quarrels purposely on others to taste their valour. Belike this is a man of that quirk?
Sir, no. His indignation derives itself out of a very competent injury. Therefore, get you on and give him his desire. Back you shall not to the house, unless you undertake that with me, which with as much safety you might answer him. Therefore on, or strip your sword stark naked, for meddle you must, that's certain, or forswear to wear iron about you.
In those days, giving up your sword meant giving up your rank and social status forever. Viola says, this is ridiculous.
This is as uncivil as strange. I beseech you, do me this courteous office, as to know of the knight what my offence to him is. It is something of my negligence, nothing of my purpose.
Please, ask Sir Andrew what's wrong. It can't be anything I've done to him.
I will do so. Signor Fabian, stay you by this gentleman till my return.
Sir Toby leaves.
Pray you, sir, do you know of this matter?
I know the knight is incensed against you, even to a mortal arbitrement.
He says that Sir Andrew is so angry that he'll fight you to the death.
But nothing of that circumstance more.
I beseech you, what manner of man is he?
Nothing of that wonderful promise to read him by his form, as you are like to find him in the proof of his valour. He is indeed, sir, the most skilful, bloody, and fatal opposite that you could possibly have found in any part of Illyria. Will you walk towards him? I will make your peace with him if I can.
I shall be much bound to you, Fort. I am one that had rather go with Sir Priest than Sir Knight. I care not who knows so much of my mettle.
In Shakespeare's day, both priests and knights were called Sir, and Viola doesn't care what people think of her, but she'd rather spend time with a priest than a knight. Fabian and Viola leave, and the scene shifts into the street outside the garden wall. The continuation of this scene in a new setting is a little odd, and it's likely that it was originally written as two. Twelfth Night was not published in any form until the first folio of 1623. This was a collaboration between two of Shakespeare's acting troupe, Hemmings and Condell, and his friend and fellow writer, Ben Jonson. While they tried to present the most complete versions of the plays they had access to, there are some anomalies, and this is probably one of them. So the scene continues with Sir Toby telling Sir Andrew what a fierce young man Cesario is.
Why, man, he's a very devil. I have not seen such a farrago.
A farrago is a fire eater. Toby is getting Andrew all worked up and scared.
I had a pass with him. Rapier, scabbard and all. And he gives me the stuck-in with such a mortal motion that it is inevitable. And on the answer, he pays you as surely as your feet hit the ground they step on.
Oh.
They say he has been fencer to the Sophie.
Sir Toby lies, saying he had a short sword fight with Cesario and can confirm that he is a master swordsman. He even worked for the Shah of Persia.
Pox on! I'll not meddle with him.
Aye, but he will not now be pacified. Fabian can scarce hold him yonder.
Plague on't! And I thought he had been valiant and so cunning in fence, I'd have seen him damned ere I'd have challenged him. Let him let the matter slip, and I'll give him my horse, Grey Capulet.
I'll make the motion. Stand here. Make a good show, Aunt. This shall end without the perdition of souls. Marry, I'll ride your horse as well as I ride you.
Sir Andrew would never have challenged Cesario if he thought him brave, and asks Sir Toby to try and bribe him with his fine horse as payment. Sir Toby agrees, and in an aside, says that he'll ride his horse as he rides him. Sir Toby is the puppet master, and can make Sir Andrew do whatever he wants. Now Fabian enters with Cesario, and from opposite sides of the stage, the would-be fighters look nervously at one another. Sir Toby and Fabian meet in the middle.
I have his horse to take up the quarrel. I have persuaded him the youth's a devil.
He is as horribly conceited of him, and pants and looks pale as if a bear were at his heels.
They are both equally scared. Then Toby turns to Viola and says,
There's no remedy, sir. He will fight with you for oath's sake. Marry, he hath better bethought him of his quarrel, and he finds that now scarce to be worth talking of. Therefore, draw for the supportance of his vow. He protests he will not hurt you.
And Viola, in an aside to the audience, says,
Pray God defend me. A little thing would make me tell them how much I lack of a man.
She lacks a little thing to make her a man. Yep, a penis.
Give ground if you seem furious.
Come, Sir Andrew, there's no remedy. The gentleman will, for his honour's sake, have one bout with you. He cannot, by the duello, avoid it. But he has promised me, as he is a gentleman and a soldier, he will not hurt you. Come on, to it!
So they must fight, because once a challenge has been issued, a duel must be fought. But Sir Toby tells Sir Andrew that it's just for show, that Cesario has sworn not to hurt him.
Pray God he keeps his oath.
I do assure you, 'tis against my will.
So the comical fight begins, and they are pathetic. Both scared stiff, their eyes almost closed, they circle one another, shakily holding out their swords. Then Antonio bursts in, and believing Sebastian is in danger, rushes at Sir Andrew.
Put up your sword. If this young gentleman have done offence, I take the fault on me. If you offend him, I for him defy you.
You, sir? Why? What are you?
Antonio draws his sword, ready to fight for Sebastian, never thinking for a second it isn't Sebastian but Viola, his sister.
One, sir, that for his love dares yet do more than you have heard him brag to you he will.
I love this young man, and I'll protect him to the death. What a hero. But now Sir Toby draws his sword.
Nay, if you be an undertaker, I am for you.
He means one who undertakes to fight for another, in his place, like a substitute. Antonio is clearly a tough, experienced fighter, so it's quite brave of Sir Toby to draw at this point and put himself forward to be sub for Sir Andrew. Suddenly in comes the army police officers of the night, who are keeping an eye on the peace.
Oh, good Sir Toby, hold! Here come the officers! I'll be with you anon!
I'll get you later, Antonio.
Oh, pray, sir, put your sword up! If you please.
Oh, marry will I, sir. And for that I promised you I'll be as good as my word. He will bear you easily and reins well.
Of course, Sir Andrew means the horse he offered earlier. He doesn't know that Toby didn't pass the offer on, so Viola looks blank. The officers close in around Antonio, who still stands with his sword drawn.
This is the man. Do thy office.
Antonio, I arrest thee at the suit of Count Orsino.
That's why the watch are here. They've spotted Antonio and are going to arrest him as an enemy of Orsino's.
You do mistake me, sir.
Oh, no, sir, no jot. I know your favour well, though now you have no sea cap on your head. Take him away. He knows I know him well.
I must obey.
Now Antonio turns to Viola, believing her to be Sebastian.
This comes with seeking you. But there's no remedy. I shall answer it.
It's your fault I'm caught, he says.
What will you do now my necessity makes me to ask you for my purse?
But Antonio will need some money, so he asks Viola for his purse. Remember, he gave it to Sebastian earlier. But this isn't Sebastian.
It grieves me much more for what I cannot do for you than what befalls myself. You stand amazed. But be of comfort.
Come, sir, away.
I must entreat you some of that money.
What money, sir? for the fair kindness you have showed me here, and part being prompted by your present trouble, out of my lean and low ability, I'll lend you something. My having is not much. I'll make division of my present with you. Hold, there's half my coffer.
She offers him half of what she has, but it isn't much. Antonio begins to think he's been double-crossed.
Will you deny me now? Is it possible that my deserts to you can lack persuasion? Oh, do not tempt my misery, lest that it make me so unsound a man as to upbraid you with those kindnesses that I have done for you.
Antonio is shattered that the man he rescued, cares for, loves, could do this to him.
I know of none, nor know I you by voice or any feature. I hate ingratitude more in a man than lying, vainness, babbling drunkenness, or any taint of vice whose strong corruption inhabits our frail blood.
Oh, heavens themselves!
Come, sir, I pray you, go.
Let me speak a little. This youth that you see here, I snatched one half out of the jaws of death, relieved him with such sanctity of love, and to his image, which methought did promise most venerable worth, did I devotion.
What's that to us? The time goes by. Away.
But oh, how vile an idol proves this god. Thou hast, Sebastian, done good feature shame. In nature there's no blemish but the mind. None can be called deformed but the unkind. Virtue is beauty. But the beauteous evil are empty trunks or flourished by the devil.
Antonio is beside himself. He begins to realize that he fell in love with Sebastian's looks and sees how wrong that was. Beauty should be more than skin deep, but below the surface he fears that Sebastian is empty and vile. Shakespeare shows us that in nature there is nothing uglier than the human mind and the cruel tricks it can play.
The man grows mad. Away with him. Come, sir.
Lead me on.
Defeated and depressed, Antonio allows himself to be led away.
Methinks his words do from such passion fly, that he believes himself. Oh, so do not I. Prove true, imagination. Oh, prove true that I, dear brother, be now ta'en for you.
Antonio is so incensed by her betrayal that she wonders if he's mistaken her for her brother. As she thinks this through, Sir Toby, Fabian, and Sir Andrew gather to talk amongst themselves.
Come hither, knight. Come hither, Fabian. We'll whisper o'er a couplet or two of most sage saws.
So they move to one side to talk about what happens now. Viola is centre stage.
He named Sebastian. I, my brother, know, yet living in my glass. Even such and so in favour was my brother, and he went still in this fashion. Colour, ornament, for him I imitate.
Looking at herself in the mirror dressed as a boy, she knows she is the spitting image of her brother.
Oh, if it prove, tempests are kind and salt waves fresh in love.
He must be alive. And forgetting the duel, she leaves.
A very dishonest, paltry boy, and more a coward than a hare. His dishonesty appears in leaving his friend here in necessity, and denying him. And for his cowardship, ask Fabian.
A coward. A most devout coward. Religious in it.
They believe Cesario betrayed Antonio, which makes him a coward and a creep. The dejected Sir Andrew perks up at the thought that he's less of a coward than his opponent.
Slid, I'll after him again and beat him.
Slid, an oath, short for God's eyelid.
Do, cuff him soundly, but never draw thy sword.
And I do not.
Come,
let's see the event.
I dare lay any money, 'twill be nothing yet.
The three of them leave, and that ends Act Three.
Thank you.
Act 4, Scene 1. This opens in the street, close by Olivia's house. Olivia has sent Feste out to find Cesario and persuade him to visit her. Enter Sebastian and Feste.
Will you make me believe that I am not sent for you?
Go to. Go to. Thou art a foolish fellow. Let me be clear of thee.
Well held out, i' faith. No, I do not know you, nor I am not sent to you by my lady to bid you come speak with her. Nor your name is not Master Cesario, nor this is not my nose neither. Nothing that is so is so.
Nothing that is so is so. Feste's right. In the topsy-turvy world of the play, you can't trust your eyes, and nothing is what it seems.
I prithee, vent thy folly somewhere else. Thou knowest not me.
Vent mere folly? He has heard that word of some great man, and now applies it to a fool. Vent mere folly. I am afraid this great lubber, the world, will prove a cockney.
Feste, who prides himself on his wordplay, takes great exception to this upstart lad getting huffy with him and ridicules his accent, making him out to be an affected Londoner.
Oh, we've all got to speak affected now, like a Londoner, have we?
Of course, this is all very funny for the London audience, and once again shows how Shakespeare drifts from Illyria to London when he wants to crack a joke.
I prithee now, ungird thy strangeness and tell me what I shall vent to my lady. Shall I vent to her that thou art coming?
I prithee, foolish Greek, depart from me. There's money for thee. If you tarry longer, I shall give worse payment.
By my troth, thou hast an open hand. These wise men that give fools money get themselves a good report. After 14 years' purchase.
Sebastian is trying to pay Feste cash to leave him alone, and Feste reckons he is the type who will pay more than the going rate for an easy life. At the time the play was written, property was bought for the price of 10 years' rent, and Feste reckons Sebastian would pay 14 years' purchase. Now Sir Toby, Fabian and Sir Andrew enter. On seeing Sebastian, who they too believe is Cesario, a coward and a betrayer of friends, Sir Andrew marches up and slaps him around the face with his glove.
Now, sir, have I met you again? There's for you.
Sebastian is dumbstruck for a second, but then launches into Sir Andrew, striking him with each word, using the butt of his dagger.
Why, there's for thee. Ow! And there. Ow! And there.
Ow! And as he hits Sir Andrew, he can't help but think,
are all the people mad?
Hold, sir, or I'll throw your dagger over the house.
Sir Toby grabs the struggling Sebastian.
This will I tell my lady straight. I would not be in some of your coats for 2 pence.
He says he wouldn't switch places with Sir Toby, Andrew or Fabian, not even if you paid him. Convinced that Cesario is mad, Feste keeps out of the scuffle and goes to tell Olivia what's happening.
Come on, sir, hold!
Nay, let him alone. I'll go another way to work with him. I'll have an action of battery against him, if there be any law in Illyria. Though I struck him first, yet it's no matter for that.
Sir Andrew might not win in a fight, but he can use the law and sue him for battery, even though he did strike the first blow.
Let go thy hand.
Come, sir, I will not let you go. Come, my young soldier, put up your iron. You are well-fleshed. Come on.
By well-fleshed, he means you've tasted blood. That should be enough for you.
I will be free from thee. What wouldst thou now? If thou dare tempt me further, draw thy sword.
And Sebastian draws his sword. So, of course, Sir Toby does the same.
What? What? Nay then, I must have an ounce or two of this malapert blood from you.
Malapert means cheeky. The boy should know his elders and betters. Again, Toby shows he's no coward and is ready to fight when in rushes Olivia, thinking her uncle is about to kill the man she loves.
Hold, Toby! On thy life I charge thee, hold!
Madam!
Will it be ever thus? Ungracious wretch, fit for the mountains and the barbarous caves where manners ne'er were preached, out of my sight!
Olivia is really mad at Sir Toby this time. Must she always have to be there to keep him from acting like an ignorant barbarian? She orders him to leave her sight.
Be not offended, dear Cesario.
Then to Toby.
Rudesby, be gone!
So Toby, Andrew and Fabian leave. Now Olivia is alone with the man of her dreams. Sort of.
I prithee, gentle friend, let thy fair wisdom, not thy passion, sway in this uncivil and unjust extent against thy peace. Go with me to my house, and hear thou there how many fruitless pranks this ruffian hath botched up, that thou thereby mayst smile at this. Thou shalt not choose but go. Do not deny. Beshrew his soul for me. He started one poor heart of mine in thee.
What must Sebastian think? He's been pestered by a fool who was certain he knew him, slapped by a stick-thin idiot, and then set upon by his friends. And now this unknown woman invites him into her house.
What relish is in this? How runs the stream? Or am I mad, or else this is a dream? Let fancy still my sense in Lethe steep. If it be thus to dream, still let me sleep.
If insanity is the norm in this world, then maybe it's Sebastian who is mad. He wonders if he's dreaming, and if he is, he'd like to stay asleep. The Lethe he wants to soak in is a river that, according to Greek legend, flows into hell, and drinking its water makes you forget everything.
Nay, come, I prithee. Would thou'st be ruled by me?
Madam, I will.
Oh, say so, and so be.
And without a care, Sebastian allows himself to be led away by this complete stranger. Act 4, Scene 2. We are in Olivia's house. Enter Feste and Maria. Not content with humiliating Malvolio before Olivia, Maria and Sir Toby have him bound in a dark room and are planning even more psychological torture. Maria is dressing Feste in a black gown and false beard.
Nay, I prithee, put on this gown and this beard. Make him believe thou art Sir Topas the curate. Do it quickly. I'll call Sir Toby the whilst.
While Feste dresses as a curate, that's a priest who takes particular care of his parishioners' souls, Maria goes to fetch Sir Toby.
Well, I'll put it on, and I will dissemble myself in't. And I would I were the first that ever dissembled in such a gown.
Dissemble means to lie, and so Feste lies by disguising himself as a priest, but adds that he's not the first deceiver to wear a priest's gown. This is very biting satire, accusing priests of being liars and hypocrites.
I'm not tall enough to become the function well, nor lean enough to be thought a good student. But to be said an honest man and a good housekeeper goes as fairly as to say a careful man and a great scholar.
Again, he attacks the clergy, saying those that pontificate are tall so they can look down on their parishioners, and those that study are lean because they're too focused on their work. Yet they're no better than an honest man or a housekeeper.
Ah, the competitors enter.
And Maria returns with Toby.
Jove bless thee, Master Parson.
And in a stupid voice with bad Latin, Feste speaks.
Bonus dias, Sir Toby. For as the old hermit of Prague, that never saw pen and ink, very wittily said to a niece of King Gorbajuch.
He was an ancient king of Britain.
That is. So I, being Master Parson, am Master Parson. For what is that, and is but is?
Feste mocks the way clerics speak.
To him, Sir Topas.
Together they go to Malvolio's dark cell.
What ho, I say! Peace in this prison!
The knave counterfeits well. A good knave.
Sir Toby is impressed with Feste's impersonation of a curate. And from inside this black prison, we hear the voice of Malvolio.
Who calls there?
Sir Topaz, the curate who comes to visit Malvolio, the lunatic.
Oh, Sir Topaz, good Sir Topaz, go to my lady.
Out, hyperbolical fiend! How vexest thou this man? Talkest thou nothing but of ladies?
Well said, Master Parson.
Sir Topaz, never was man thus wronged, good Sir Topaz. Do not think I am mad. They have laid me here in hideous darkness.
Fie, thou dishonest Satan! I call thee by the most modest terms, for I am one of those gentle ones that will use the devil himself with courtesy. Sayest thou that house is dark?
As hell, Sir Topas.
Why, it hath bay windows transparent as barricados, and the clerestories towards the south-north are as lustrous as ebony. And yet complainest thou of obstruction?
Feste will twist Malvolio's every word. Malvolio says he is in pitch blackness, but Feste tells him that bay windows let in light, so how can he complain of darkness?
I am not mad, Sir Topas. I say to you, this house is dark.
Madman, thou errest. I say there is no darkness but ignorance, in which thou art more puzzled than the Egyptians in their fog.
This is Feste at his best. No darkness but ignorance. And of course it is self-ignorance that is Malvolio's weakness. That he didn't know his place and position in life and wanted more. Feste suggests his fall is punishment from God, like the Egyptians in their fog, which was the ninth plague sent to force them to free the Israelites.
I say this house is as dark as ignorance, though ignorance were as dark as hell. I say there never was man thus abused. I am no more mad than you are. Make the trial of it in any constant question.
And Malvolio walks straight into it. He has no idea that he's being set up, and he can't win against Feste. They know he's not mad, but they might make him. Like Feste's earlier questioning of Olivia to see who is the bigger fool, Feste now tests Malvolio's grip on reality.
What is the opinion of Pythagoras concerning wild fowl?
That the soul of our grandam might happily inhabit a bird.
Now this is the right answer to the question, because Pythagoras believed people's souls transmigrated into birds after death, and Malvolio demonstrates that with the example of his grandmother. But Feste catches him out.
What thinkest thou of his opinion?
I think nobly of the soul, and in no way approve his opinion.
Fare thee well. Remain thou still in darkness. Thou shalt hold the pinion of Pythagoras ere I will allow of thy wits, and fear to kill a woodcock, lest thou dispossess the soul of thy grandam. Fare thee well.
Malvolio answers as any priest would have, but Feste acts as though he's committed heresy and condemns him to stay until he agrees with Pythagoras.
Sir Topas! Sir Topas!
Feste walks away from the cell to join Sir Toby and Mariah a little way off.
My most exquisite Sir Topas!
Nay, I am for all waters.
Thou mightst have done this without thy beard and gown. He sees thee not.
He needn't have dressed up for Malvolio, but it's great for a theatre audience.
To him in thine own voice, and bring me word how thou find'st him. I would we were well rid of this knavery. If he may be conveniently delivered, I would he were, for I am now so far in offence with my niece that I cannot pursue with any safety this sport to the upshot.
Toby thinks they may have taken the joke too far and asks Feste to go back to Malvolio as himself to find out how he's doing. He's dependent on Olivia for money and he doesn't know how she'll take their making such a fool of her steward. Maybe they should find a way to free him now they have cut him down to size.
Come, by and by, to my chamber.
Toby invites Mariah to come back to his room, and they leave. Feste removes the Sir Topas outfit and goes back to Malvolio.
Hey, Robin, jolly Robin, tell me how thy lady does.
Fool!
Malvolio recognises his voice, though of course he doesn't realise he's just visited him as Sir Topas.
My lady is unkind, Purdy.
Fool!
Alas, why is she so?
Fool, I say!
She loves an... Who calls, huh?
Good fool, as ever thou wilt deserve well at my hand. Help me to a candle and pen, ink and paper, as I'm a gentleman. I will live to be thankful to thee for it.
Master Malvolio?
Aye, good fool.
Alas, sir, how fell you beside your five wits?
Fool, there was never man so notoriously abused. I am as well in my wits, fool, as thou art.
But as well? Then you are mad indeed if you be no better in your wits than a fool.
They have propertied me and keep me in darkness, sent ministers to me, asses, and do all they can to face me out of my wits.
Advise you what you say. The minister is here.
And Feste really twists the knife here by playing both himself and Sir Topas.
Malvolio, Malvolio, thy wits the heavens restore. Endeavour thyself to sleep and leave thy vain bibble-babble.
To Sir Topas.
Maintain no words with him, good fellow.
Who? I, sir? Not I, sir. God bar you, good Sir Topas.
Marry. Amen.
I will, sir. I will.
Fool. Fool, I say.
Alas, sir, be patient. What say you, sir? I'm shent for speaking to you.
He will be reprimanded for talking with Malvolio.
Good fool. Help me to some light and some paper. I tell thee, I am as well in my wits as any man in Illyria.
Well a day that you were, sir.
By this hand I am, good fool. Some ink, paper, and light, and convey what I will set down to my lady. It shall advantage thee more than ever the bearing of letter did.
Malvolio wants to write to Olivia, imploring her to release him. He promises money to Feste if he'll help him.
I will help you, Toot. But tell me true. Are you not mad indeed, or do you but counterfeit?
Believe me, I am not. I tell thee true.
Nay, I'll never believe a madman till I see his brains. I will fetch you light and paper and ink.
Fool, I'll requite it in the highest degree. I prithee be gone.
I am gone, sir, and anon, sir, I'll be with you again. In a trice, like to the old vice, your need to sustain, who with dagger of lath in his rage and his wrath cries, aha to the devil, like a mad lad, pare thy nails, dad, adieu, goodman devil.
And with a song, Feste leaves Malvolio, still locked in a darkened room. And that ends scene two. Act four, scene three. Sebastian is walking in Olivia's garden.
Oh, this is the air. That is the glorious sun. This pearl she gave me, I do feel and see it, and though 'tis wonder that enwraps me thus, yet 'tis not madness. Where's Antonio, then? I could not find him at the Elephant. Yet there he was, and there I found this credit, that he did range the town to seek me out. His counsel now might do me golden service. For though my soul disputes well with my sense that this may be some error, but no madness, yet doth this accident and flood of fortune so far exceed all instance, all discourse, that I am ready to distrust mine eyes and wrangle with my reason that persuades me to any other trust but that I am mad. Or else the lady's mad. Yet if 'twere so, she could not sway her house. Command her followers, take and give back affairs and their dispatch with such a smooth, discreet, and stable bearing as I perceive she does. There's something in't that is deceivable. But here the lady comes.
Sebastian feels great. He does question whether Olivia is crazy and would like to have Antonio's advice if only he were around to give it. He knows that Antonio has been looking for him too, but now seems to have disappeared. So is Olivia mad? He recognises how effectively she runs her household, how well she's treated him, even given him an expensive jewel. And his doubts about her sanity seem to disappear as she enters with an old priest in tow.
Blame not this haste of mine. If you mean well, now go with me and with this holy man into the chantry by. There, before him, and underneath that consecrated roof, plight me the full assurance of your faith.
Because the man she thinks is Cesario is happy to be with her, she wants to make a formal commitment and get engaged before a holy man.
That my most jealous and too doubtful soul may live at peace.
Well, at least she knows she's a paranoid, jealous woman.
He shall conceal it, whiles you are willing it shall come to note. What time we will our celebration keep according to my birth. What do you say?
The priest will keep the engagement secret until they can plan the actual wedding.
I'll follow this good man and go with you, and having sworn truth, ever will be true.
Then lead the way, good father, and heaven so shine that they may fairly note this act of mine.
So Sebastian has no qualms about pledging to marry a woman he's only just met, and Olivia is happy to make the running and take charge. They follow the priest into the house, and that ends Act Four. Act 5, Scene 1. Outside Olivia's house in the street. Fabian and Feste are talking.
Now, as thou lovest me, let me see his letter.
He's talking about the letter Malvolio's written with the pen and paper he begged from Feste. Malvolio hopes it will prove his sanity and secure his release from the dark room, where he is still held captive.
Good Master Fabian, grant me another request.
Anything.
Do not desire to see this letter.
This is to give a dog, and in recompense desire my dog again.
This business about the dog refers to a story that the London audience would have known well. Apparently, Queen Elizabeth asked her relative, Dr. Boleyn, to grant her a wish, and in return, she would grant him one. She asked for his dog, and he gave it to her, but because he loved it so much, he used his wish to ask for it back. As they argue over the letter, Orsino arrives with full pomp and pageantry. His entourage includes Curio and Cesario, also known as Viola. Instead of sending others to woo Olivia, Orsino has come to speak for himself. He approaches Fabian and Feste, and at first doesn't recognise them.
Belong you to the Lady Olivia, friends?
Aye, sir. We are some of her trappings.
I know thee well. How dost thou, my good fellow?
Truly, sir, the better for my foes and the worse for my friends.
Just the contrary, the better for thy friends.
No, sir, the worse.
How can that be?
Marry, sir, they praise me and make an ass of me. Now, my foes tell me plainly I am an ass. So that by my foes, sir, I profit in the knowledge of myself. And by my friends, I am abused. So that, conclusions to be as kisses, if your four negatives make your two affirmatives, why then, the worse for my friends and the better for my foes.
His enemies tell him plainly that he is an ass, and so he learns something about himself. But his friends wouldn't say such things, and so he learns nothing. Therefore, his friends abuse him by teaching him nothing.
Why, this is excellent.
By my troth, sir, no. Though it please you to be one of my friends.
By Feste's logic, if Orsino is considered to be a friend, then he too is an abuser. And not wanting to be seen in such a light, Orsino pays him a tip.
Thou shalt not be the worse for me. There's gold.
But that it would be double dealing, sir. I would you could make it another.
He always asks them to double the tip.
Oh, you give me ill counsel.
Put your grace in your pocket, sir, for this once, and let your flesh and blood obey it.
Well, I will be so much a sinner to be a double dealer. There's another.
Primo, secundo, tertio is a good play, and the old saying is, the third pays for all. The triplex, sir, is a good tripping measure. Or the bells of St. Bennet, sir, may put you in mind. One, two, three...
Always trying to increase the tip, he asks for three now. A triplex was a popular triple-time dance, by the way, and the three bells of St. Benedict's, or St. Bennet's Church, could be heard at the Globe, as it was close by. Again, Shakespeare drops the pretense of being in Illyria and plays to the London crowd.
You can fool no more money out of me at this throw. If you will let your lady know I am here to speak with her and bring her along with you, it may awake my bounty further.
Marry, sir, lullaby to your bounty till I come again. I go, sir, but I would not have you to think that my desire of having is the sin of covetousness. But, as you say, sir, let your bounty take a nap. I will awake it anon.
Orsino has reached his limit for now, and Feste leaves without a third coin. He says he doesn't want to appear greedy, but will return after Orsino's generosity has had a rest. As he leaves, two guards enter with their prisoner, Antonio.
Here comes the man, sir, that did rescue me.
Oh, that face of his I do remember well. Yet when I saw it last, it was besmeared as black as Vulcan in the smoke of war.
Their last meeting was at the sea battle Antonio recalled earlier. But then Antonio was all dirty, black as Vulcan, who is the Roman god of fire and metal.
A baubling vessel was he captain of, for shallow draught and bulk unprizable, with which such scathful grapple did he make with the most noble bottom of our fleet, that very envy and the tongue of loss cried fame and honour on him.
So Antonio's ship was small, but it had a large flat bottom that could stay high in the water. This meant they could manoeuvre more easily and go where the larger ships could not. It was this kind of ship that Drake used to defeat the Spanish Armada in 1588. Even though the Spanish had the greater firepower, they were beaten by the smaller ships.
What's the matter?
Orsino, this is that Antonio that took the Phoenix and her fraught from Candy. And this is he that did the tiger board when your young nephew Titus lost his leg. Here, in the streets, desperate of shame and state, in private brabble did we apprehend him.
So it's not just business, it's personal. Orsino's nephew, Titus, lost his leg in the attack. No wonder Antonio feared being caught by Orsino's men. The officer says they found him in a brabble, or public brawl, and Viola, Cesario, of course, explains that Antonio got involved to help her.
He did me kindness, sir, drew on my side, but in conclusion put strange speech upon me. I know not what 'twas. But distraction.
She describes how he fought on her behalf, but afterwards said things that made no sense at all.
Notable pirate, thou saltwater thief, what foolish boldness brought thee to their mercies, whom thou in terms so bloody and so dear hast made thine enemies?
So Orsino has some respect for him, but he asks what made him show his face in a town where he has so many enemies.
Orsino, noble sir, be pleased that I shake off these names you give me. Antonio never yet was thief or pirate, though I confess on base and ground enough Orsino's enemy.
Antonio says he's not a thief or a pirate, but understands why Orsino considers him an enemy. And he looks directly at Viola, who he thinks is Sebastian.
A witchcraft drew me hither. That most ingrateful boy there by your side, from the rude seas enraged and foamy mouth did I redeem. A rack past hope he was.
He saved Sebastian from the shipwreck.
His life I gave him, and did thereto add my love, without retention or restraint, all his in dedication. For his sake did I expose myself, pure for his love, into the danger of this adverse town. Drew to defend him when he was beset, where being apprehended, his false cunning, not meaning to partake with me in danger, taught him to face me out of his acquaintance, and grew a 20 years removed thing while one would wink. Denied me mine own purse, which I had recommended to his use not half an hour before.
Believing Viola is Sebastian, Antonio looks her straight in the eye and describes how he put himself in danger's way because he loves him. And now, in his hour of need, he's treated like a stranger, and his own money held back.
How can this be?
When came he to this town?
Today, my lord. And for 3 months before, no interim, not a minute's vacancy. Both day and night did we keep company.
We arrived today and have been together every minute for the last 3 months. From the other side of the stage, Olivia whisks on with her entourage of servants and attendants.
Here comes the Countess. Now heaven walks on earth. But for thee, fellow. Fellow, thy words are madness. 3 months this youth hath tended upon me.
That can't be. He's been with me for the last 3 months. At this point, neither Orsino nor Antonio has used first names, but said youth and boy. And so they have no idea that Antonio's talking about Sebastian and Orsino is talking about Cesario.
But more of that anon. Take him aside.
The soldiers drag Antonio to the side of the stage as Olivia and Orsino confront each other in the centre.
What would my lord, but that he may not have, wherein Olivia may seem serviceable?
Why are you here when you know you can't have what you want?
Cesario, you do not keep promise with me.
Madam?
Gracious Olivia.
What do you say, Cesario? Good, my lord.
Orsino wants to speak to Olivia, but her eyes are fixed upon Cesario. She's starting to panic. Has Cesario betrayed her? Viola, of course, feels uncomfortable and tries to get Olivia to talk to Orsino.
My lord would speak. My duty hushes me. If it be aught to the old tune, my lord, it is as fat and fulsome to mine ear as howling after music.
Oh, not that old tune again. To Olivia's ear, it sounds like howling dogs, not sweet music.
Still so cruel.
Still so constant, lord.
What? To perverseness? You uncivil lady, to whose ingrate and unauspicious altars my soul the faithfulest offerings hath breathed out that e'er devotion tendered. What shall I do?
What an ego! Just because he's poured out his heart, she should be grateful. If she only understood the intensity of his feelings, she couldn't help but return his love. There must be a way to make her love him. Even now, face to face, he still won't take no for an answer.
Even what it please my lord that shall become him.
Why should I not, had I the heart to do it, like to the Egyptian thief at point of death, kill what I love?
If he can't have Olivia, maybe he should kill her so nobody can. The Egyptian reference is to Phaimus, an Egyptian robber chief who, when surrounded by enemies, killed his lover so she could accompany him into the afterlife.
A savage jealousy that sometimes savours nobly. But hear me this. Since you to non-regardance cast my faith, and that I partly know the instrument that screws me from my true place in your favour, live you, the marble-breasted tyrant, still. But this, your minion, whom I know you love, and whom, by heaven, I swear I tender dearly, him will I tear out of that cruel eye where he sits crowned in his master's spite.
Orsino is angry now. He's worked out that Olivia has fallen for the servant and not the master. But she will have to live alone, as a statue, without love. Orsino believes that his rightful place is beside Olivia, and even though he cares deeply for Cesario, he will not allow them to be together.
Come, boy, with me. My thoughts are ripe in mischief. I'll sacrifice the lamb that I do love to spite a raven's heart within a dove.
He will kill the lamb he loves, Cesario, to spite the beautiful and cruel Olivia, the raven-hearted dove.
And I, most jocund, apt and willingly, to do you rest, 1,000 deaths would die.
Viola would happily die 1,000 deaths to be with Orsino.
Where goes Cesario? After him I love, more than I love these eyes, more than my life, more by all mores than e'er I shall love wife. If I do feign, you witnesses above punish my life for tainting of my love.
I me detest it. How am I beguiled?
Olivia feels betrayed, tricked. She doesn't understand why her fiancé would say that he loves Orsino.
Who does beguile you? Who does do you wrong?
Hast thou forgot thyself? Is it so long? Call forth the Holy Father.
Olivia cannot believe Cesario has forgotten and calls the priest to come and testify that they are pledged to each other. An attendant is dispatched to get the priest.
Come, away.
Whither, my lord? Cesario.
And Orsino grabs Viola. They almost make it off the stage when Olivia drops her bombshell.
Husband! Stay.
Husband?
Aye, husband.
Can he that deny?
Viola is knocked for six. Dumbfounded. Orsino looks at Viola and asks...
Her husband, Sirrah?
No, my lord, not I.
Alas, it is the baseness of thy fear that makes thee strangle thy propriety.
Oh, you're too frightened of Orsino to admit your identity as my fiancé.
Fear not, Cesario. Take thy fortunes up. Be that thou knowest thou art, and then thou art as great as that thou fearest.
Don't worry. Marrying me will make you as important as the man you fear. And now enters the priest that Olivia sent for, to prove that she is indeed bonded to Cesario.
Oh, welcome, father.
Father, I charge thee by thy reverence, here to unfold, though lately we intended to keep in darkness what occasion now reveals before 'tis ripe. What thou dost know hath newly passed.